So this is going to be a somewhat more general talk that's meant to introduce what's going on in this program on scattering amplitudes. And this is a subject that I think many of us who are involved in feel extremely excited about right now. And it's progressing at a remarkable pace. There's lots of incredibly interesting physical and mathematical issues that are being exposed by these investigations. So what I want to do is tell you about what some of the essential issues are. And maybe by way of introduction, I can start saying that I think you could say that the last 20 years have seen a real explosion in our understanding of what quantum field theories can do. Quantum field theories turn out to be even remarkably richer than anyone anticipated before. And with the understanding of the what happens when the coupling constant becomes very strong, for a long time there was no good even qualitative or quantitative picture for what should happen. But starting around 20 years ago, there started to be some understanding of what happens when the coupling becomes strong, and extraordinary things happened when the couplings became strong. There were dual descriptions of the same kinds of physics, theories without even Lagrangian descriptions were discovered, the most remarkable thing of all that was discovered is that good old-fashioned ordinary quantum field theories in four space-time dimensions could, at strong coupling, turn into string theory, extra dimensions, gravity, all the rest of it in anti de Sitter space. That's, I think, the most spectacular thing we've learned that quantum field theories can do at strong coupling. But it's also fair to say that all of these amazing things that happened were where we had no idea what to expect. There was no picture for what should happen at strong coupling. There be monsters, and instead of monsters, we found all these incredible dual descriptions, and in fact found theories of quantum gravity sitting under our noses. I think one of the interesting things which has been going on in the past decade and sort of intensifying is the realization that there's something similar going on, not just at strong coupling, but even at weak coupling. Even in the part of the physics that we thought we've understood since Feynman, there's something else going on. And that there's some really remarkable, again, both mathematical and physical structures underlying quantum field theory at all values of the coupling, not just at strong coupling. This has just an additional little twist of irony, again, because this is supposed to be a subject that's been well understood for 60 years, that's in all the textbooks. There's a new way of thinking about it that we're starting to understand. I should say that even though I will have zero time to talk about it here, that a lot of these remarkable surprises of both weak and strong couplings in this story, in particular in the context of maximally supersymmetric theories, have an antecedent in some amazing work that was done in the last decade in understanding the spectrum of anomalous dimensions in very, very supersymmetric theories, where there was some formulation of the problem which did not resemble in any way a Feynman diagram, weakly coupled expansion at weak coupling gave you the answers for weak coupling. And similarly, didn't resemble in any way some obvious expansion of the theory in terms of strings and extra dimensions at strong coupling. There was some third thing which in two limits remarkably yielded results that coincided with the good old-fashioned perturbation theory at weak coupling and the string picture at strong coupling. So what we're seeing now with scattering amplitudes is some elevation of that structure to something even bigger, and for a somewhat more physical set of problems which are at least very familiar. They involve good old-fashioned scattering of gluons. All right, so what are we talking about? So we're talking about scattering amplitudes in gauge theories and in gravity I'll only have time to say a little bit about gravity towards the end. And again, this is a mostly an overview. I shouldn't have to motivate why scattering amplitudes are interesting. They're the bread and butter observable for high energy physics. For instance, we might be interested in a process where two gluons come in and two gluons go out. This is something relatively simple to compute if you just open up your textbook and draw Feynman diagrams. And that's really what Feynman became famous for. Feynman became famous for figuring out how to think about scattering amplitudes by drawing these pictures that make two things manifest. The Feynman diagrams make space-time locality and quantum mechanical unitarity manifest. I feel like that was really Feynman's accomplishment, was being able to make relativity and unitarity manifest at the same time. Okay. By giving this space-time picture for what's going on. And if all you ever wanted were two-to-two scattering processes, you might be content. Actually, if you care about gravity amplitudes, even two-to-two processes turn out to be very, very complicated to compute using standard Feynman diagrams. But let me just keep going and wonder about more complicated processes. And something which is one of the wonderful facts about this business is that many of these problems were first studied for extremely practical, almost grungy reasons of trying to compute the backgrounds for exciting physics processes that would produce new particles at high energy accelerators. Typically, accelerators at the energy frontier collide protons, so you have to understand strong interaction processes. The gluons are the glue that binds the quarks together inside the protons. And because the interactions are relatively strong, there isn't so much of a price for emitting extra gluons. And so you really have to, if you want to understand the final state, you really have to be able to control and understand these processes to very high precision. That process with two gluons colliding into each other and producing four gluons coming out, depending on how you do the accounting, happens hundreds of thousands of times a second at the Large Hadron Collider. Okay? By contrast, a process one of the ones that would reveal new physics, for example, the production of superpartners in a supersymmetric theory, the typical rates for that might be measured in once a minute. Okay. So that's good. These accelerators are designed so that those timescales are a human timescale, like once a minute. So you wait a year, you have a bunch of supersymmetric particles. We have to clearly beat down these things that happen hundreds of thousands of times a second and understand them very well. So that was a big motivation for doing this kind of computation. And already this process, if you just open up the textbooks, starts looking incredibly complicated because we have interactions. We have basic interactions that are 3-point, 4-point, and 3-point interactions, and we can string them together in all sorts of different ways that you can imagine. Okay. Even the simplest leading order diagrams that don't involve any internal loops, but just involve this sort of tree-like structure, there's 220 Feynman diagrams. Depending on how you count, tens of thousands, 100,000 terms. And it's a complete nightmare. Already for the simplest possible, already for one of the simplest processes that we really need to understand very, very well. Okay, well, a very big story that started developing in the late 1980s is that despite the fact that the individual diagrams are so complicated, in special cases, people started realizing that the sums of the diagram, the final answer, was astoundingly simple. There was a one-line formula for the sum of these 220 Feynman diagrams, at least for certain external helicities. Oh, so I'll come to that in a second. You might have thought that it was a curiosity. Maybe it was only a very, very special set of things turned out to be astonishingly simple. But really, the sort of theme for the past, for the 20 years after that, has been that this astonishing simplicity persists when appropriately viewed through the appropriate lens. It persists to a point where we now have, in some sense, a complete understanding, not just for these processes, but for processes also involving the loops. In a specific sense, there's a complete understanding of them in a way that's just radically, vastly simpler than anything that you might have hoped to be able to do before. So that's what I want to tell you a little bit about, is the structure which is underlying that enormous simplicity. But before telling you about the simplicity, let me just spend a second telling you why Feynman diagrams are complicated. Why is it that an answer that ends up being expressed in terms of one or three terms, in this case, why does it look horrendously complicated in terms of the underlying Feynman diagrams? And the reason isn't some funny technical dipsy doodle. The reason is exactly these two things, which are its point in life. Okay? Making locality manifest and unitarity manifest turns out to come at a very heavy cost. And in order to explain why, let me tell you what we have to do in order to make these two things manifest. All of these interesting features begin when particles have spin greater than or equal to 1. Okay. So let's say you want to describe a photon or a gluon, so the same thing from this point of view. These are particles that are massless. They move around at the speed of light. Because they're massless, they don't have, if we had a massive spin 1 particle, it has 3 degrees of freedom. Okay. A massless spin 1 particle cannot have 3 degrees of freedom, roughly speaking, because you can never boost to a frame where it's at rest and rotate it from one direction to another direction. Okay. All massless spin 1 particles, all massless particles can have is helicity h, which is the spin in the direction of motion. So the helicity can be plus or minus 1. There's 2 degrees of freedom for a photon, 2 degrees of freedom for a gluon. Sorry, 2 degrees of freedom for photons, gluons, 2 degrees of freedom for a graviton. It happens to have helicity plus or minus 2, but there's still 2 degrees of freedom associated with it. Okay. So it's 2, not 3 degrees of freedom. This intuitive argument about not being able to boost to its frame, a fancier way of saying that is that particles are labeled by irreducible representations of the Poincaré group, and because the theory is quantum mechanical, you have to look for unitary representations of the Poincaré group, and the unitary representations, as famously shown by Wigner, are labeled by helicity. So that's where unitarity enters the story. Okay? We're looking for unitary representations. We have helicity plus or minus 2. Plus or minus 1. Now, let's say, so this is fundamentally what we have, are these particles. Let's say we want to build a theory for their interactions, which is local. Well, it's more or less a theorem, at least a folk theorem, or a Weinberg theorem, that if you want to build interactions for particles that respect locality, the thing to do is to group them together into fields. Now, these fields are just superpositions of these particles. The particles are labeled by helicity as well as their momentum p. But you just group them together in the obvious Fourier way into a field A mu of x, and then you write down local interactions for the A mus, local and x, and you integrate them over space. That guarantees that the actual interactions between the particles are local in space-time. Okay? So this is where unitarity came in. And this is where locality comes in, that we have to group these things into fields and write down local interactions for them in space-time. But you see, we have a basic problem. There are 4 degrees of freedom in the AMU, A0, A1, A2, and A3, and there's only 2 degrees of freedom in the photons. Let's see that very explicitly. If I write a plane wave solution that's supposed to correspond to a photon of some polarization, with some polarization epsilon mu, well, there's 4 epsilon mus, 0, 1, 2, 3, but there's only 2 physical degrees of freedom for the photon. So the only thing we can do, well, what can we do? We can try to impose constraints on this, like that epsilon dotted into the p is equal to 0. Okay, that's fine. That reduces us from 3 down to 2, from 4 down to 3 degrees of freedom. But we're still screwed. We need to get down to 2 degrees of freedom. And there's simply no way of doing it. There is no choice of epsilon mus, no Lorentz invariance choice of epsilon mus that have the requisite 2 degrees of freedom. So this is where a real novelty enters the discussion. The novelty is that we have to somewhat enlarge our picture of what we're allowed to talk about. We're not just going to talk about a set of states that correspond to the physical states, but we're going to introduce the idea that there's equivalence classes of states, that if I have epsilon mu of p and epsilon mu of p plus anything times p mu, that these two configurations of epsilon are to be identified. We have to declare that they're the same state. Back in position space, this is identifying A mu and A mu plus a derivative on something, okay, which is the famous gauge symmetry, although as you see, it's much more. It's not really a symmetry. It's a convenience. It's our mental convenience for describing the physics by introducing these equivalence classes and saying that these are to be identified with each other. So really, the origin of all the difficulty is this gauge redundancy, not a symmetry, but this gauge redundancy, which is the cost of describing this physics in a way that's manifestly local and manifestly unitary. What it means is that we're dragging around a huge amount of unphysical stuff in the intermediate parts of the calculation that cancel out in a very non-local way between all the terms to get the final answer. It's very hard to see that this term cancels against that term, cancels against that term. It's in an incredibly spread out way that these things end up canceling. So that's why Feynman diagrams are so complicated. They're making locality and unitarity manifest at the cost of introducing a lot of gauge redundancy in our description of the physics. And as you see, it just gets worse as you go to higher spin. If we have spin 2 particles, if we're talking about massless gravitons, there's 10 degrees of freedom in the analog of the A mu. Right now, down some H mu nu. But we again have to get down to 2. So you have to have even more redundancy. The redundancy in the case of gravitons is known as general covariance, which is also a completely fake thing, just like gate symmetry. It's completely in our heads. It's a convenience to talk about the physics. But it's vastly more of it, okay? Vastly more of it. Already in gravity, forget about something as complicated as this, already in gravity, the 3-point vertex has 80 terms in it, okay? If you want to compute just 2-to-2 scattering for gravity, unless you are Bryce DeWitt, you will have a very hard time doing it using just textbook Feynman diagrams. And yet, exactly the same thing happens. The gravity amplitudes turn out to be shockingly simpler than you'd expect from inspecting the completely hopelessly complicated Feynman diagrams. In fact, even though I won't have that much time to talk about it, and it's, this is certainly not a universally agreed upon statement, in some sense, it seems like gravity amplitudes, even though we're not quite thinking about them perfectly the correct way yet, might even be simpler than gauge theory amplitudes. At least there are some circumstantial hints that something like that is right. So it's completely the opposite from what you would expect from opening up the textbooks. You open up the textbooks, the first quantum field theory you study is phi to the fourth theory. None of this magic happens from phi to the fourth theory. Phi to the fourth theory is as crappy as it looks. Okay? But the magic begins for gauge theories, which are naively much more complicated than phi to the fourth theory, and for gravity, which is horrendously more complicated. But this is one of the very first hints that there's some second way of thinking about things where the structure of the answer is manifest. There's no free lunch, so if the structure of the answer and the simplicity of the answer is going to be manifest, what does it have to give up? It's probably not going to be manifestly local and manifestly unitary. And I think that's what we're going to start talking about. So I spent so long just on this very basic point because I think it's very important to understand that this is not some the subject is not finding a bunch of clever tricks for computing amplitudes, which are really fundamentally given by Feynman diagrams. They are given by Feynman diagrams, but this tremendous complexity in the diagrams, contrasted with the incredible simplicity and patterns in the result, is suggesting that sitting there in the structure of these theories we've been studying for 60 years is some amazing new way of thinking about the physics that that doesn't put in space-time, perhaps isn't even manifestly unitary, but gets locality and unitary out as an outcome. Okay, so let me just spend a second. I'm not going to be able to describe all the technical details here, but I'll try to hit some of the basic highlights. So, in textbooks, we normally think about the amplitude as a function of the four momenta for the particles and polarization vectors for the particles. So A will always run from 1 to n. And it's okay. So that's what it is. And we pretend that we can compute this. We do compute it. Let's say we're talking about gauge theories by computing Feynman diagrams and contracting them with the appropriate polarization vectors. Now, this is very important because the actual physical amplitude has interesting invariance properties under Lorentz transformations. Under Lorentz transformations, if you Lorentz transform the momenta, the amplitudes aren't invariant. Instead, you have to pick up a phase factor having to do with whatever helicities for the external particles are. So the amplitudes have the property that when you do a Lorentz transformation on the momenta, you have to pick up helicity rotations on the external particles. That's not what Feynman diagrams are. Feynman diagrams are honest Lorentz tensors. Okay? You do a Lorentz transformation on the p's, you get a Lorentz transformation on this m mu 1 up to mu n. That's why we introduce these polarization vectors that depend on the helicities. And we pretend that there's such a thing as the polarization vector, which eats up the Lorentz transformation properties and just gives me a helicity rotation on the epsilons. However, for the reasons we just went through, there's no such thing as that polarization vector. There is no unique such polarization vector. And that's why the amplitudes is written in books. That's why most of us have never seen an actual amplitude in a quantum field theory course. What you see is a redundant representation of one, but you never see it itself. You never see an actual function that has the correct transformation properties in the Lorentz transformations. Okay. So you would think that this is a problem that would have been solved in a chapter one, volume one of some book by somebody. Okay. But in fact, it is not. It may very well soon be, and I think all the ingredients are there. But it has not been completely solved for any quantum field theory in any number of dimensions to come up with a set of variables which have, honestly, the correct transformation laws. However, happily, in four dimensions, it's very easy to talk about such variables. And we live in four dimensions, so that's good. And these variables are known as the spinner helicity variables. And it's really part of the theme in the development of this subject. There's a hand-in-hand advance in our, the simplification in talking about the kinematics. We use the best possible variables to talk about the kinematics in the simplest possible way. And when you get used to the best possible variables, then some of the dynamics or some of the remarkable extra structures in the answer become much, much easier to spot and understand. So this is the first most basic step in that direction, which is to just look at the damn amplitudes, you know, and not some redundant representation of them. So the idea is that already when we do, when we talk about a four vector for a massless particle, we're already doing something redundant. There's four variables here, but there's a constraint that p0 squared minus p squared is equal to zero. Okay? So we'd like to talk about a massless momenta in a way that doesn't have that redundancy. The idea is to dot this p into Pauli spin matrices. So associated with p0 and p, let me just make this little 2x2 matrix. Okay, and now if you'll notice that if you look at the determinant of this 2x2 matrix, that that's just equal to p0 squared minus p squared. So this is true regardless of whether p is light-like or not. This is a very nice representation that allows you to see that the Lorentz group is actually just the group of two-dimensional complex linear transformations that conjugates this 2x2 matrix, because that preserves the determinant. But if we further assume that the particle is massless, then we learn that this 2x2 matrix has rank, has vanishing determinant, so it has rank 1, and so we can write p, so conventionally people call the two indices that this matrix has alpha and alpha dot, we can write it as just the outer product of two-dimensional vectors. So this is just the little dumb two-dimensional vector AB, this is some other dumb two-dimensional vector A tilde B tilde. That's it. Now, without any apology or explanation, I'm just going to say that this entire talk, every variable is complex. Okay? So we talk about reality only at the very, very end, or at least reality conditions. Hopefully we're talking about reality a lot more frequently. So everything is complex. So that means that lambda and lambda tilde are completely independent, complex variables. And the Lorentz group is just a separate, the complexified Lorentz group is a separate SL2 cross SL2 acting on the lambdas and acting on the lambda tildes. Okay? And that means that we can easily write down Lorentz invariants. For example, I can take two lambdas and I can contract them with an epsilon symbol. And similarly, I can take two lambda tildes and contract them. Okay. All right. Now, what's so nice about these variables? You see, now if I just hand you two random lambda and lambda tildes unconstrained, this is guaranteeing that it's building a momentum which is light-like. Okay? Now, it's, you might be confused because we don't seem to have lost the requisite degree of freedom, right? We still have 4 degrees of freedom in the lambda and the lambda tilde, not 3. That's because I can rescale lambda and lambda tilde by opposite amounts, keeping p invariant. But that's perfect. That's exactly what we want. That's the action of the helicity rotation. So in fact, we can keep track of the helicities of the particle involved just by demanding that anything I write down, which is the function of the lambdas and the lambda tildes, has some appropriate homogeneity under rescaling the lambdas. Okay, so if you take some lambda A and you multiply it by some factor TA, lambda tilde A by TA inverse, just on any one particle, this should equal TA to some particular power, which by convention we say is T to the negative 2, the helicity of the particle, M of lambda and lambda tilde. So these are exactly the variables that we want. These are the variables that are honestly, the amplitudes are functions of these variables. You do a Lorentz transformation, and you pick up the action of the helicity transformation on each one of the external particles. Just so you very quickly see the power of this way of thinking about things, let's look at something, the most basic amplitude of all in any theory, which is the three-particle amplitude. Okay? So conventionally, we don't talk about three-particle amplitudes in textbooks because the amplitude has no phase space for real momenta. But it's very easy to convince yourself, that's a little exercise you can do, that is completely meaningful for complex momenta. Okay? So we can talk about the three-point function for complex momenta. Furthermore, if you just look at the momentum conservation for these three particles, using the fact that those are two-dimensional vectors, you can very easily convince yourself that this is only possible if all the lambdas are proportional to each other, or all the lambda tildes are proportional to each other. And so, therefore, any non-trivial function here can only depend either on the lambdas or on the lambda tildes, because the only invariants that we can have involve contracting them. And so, one set of invariants vanishes, or the other set of invariants vanishes. And so this allows us to right away, without any assumptions, without any anything, let's say for fun, we have three particles of spin S. Let's say they all have spin S. The generalization to any spins is, by spin I really mean helicity. Okay? So let's say two of them are plus and one of them is minus. Okay? You can immediately write down what the three particle amplitude can be up to a constant, simply because it's completely determined by Lorentz invariants. Okay. In fact, this configuration, let me do it, two minuses and a plus, is 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of s times a constant. So you can see, if you rescale 1, for example, there's 3 1s upstairs, 1 1 downstairs, so there's a net 2 1s upstairs. So the whole thing goes like T to the 2s, which is perfectly compatible with particle 1 being negative helicity. Okay? All right. Now, this already is a remarkable formula. It already tells you that there's a very interesting relationship, for example, between Yang-Mills three-point functions and gravity three-point functions. The gravity three-point function is the square of the Yang-Mills three-point function. Okay? Already, this incredibly basic fact is amazingly non-obvious from the Lagrangian. Again, the three-point function for the gravity Lagrangian is 80 terms. Not so for the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. Totally not obvious, just staring at the Lagrangian, that this simple relationship is true, but it's completely obviously true. So already you're seeing some great payoff for starting to think about the amplitudes in a more physical way. Now, let me talk about a more interesting set of amplitudes that are more physical. So if we go back to the problem that we started talking about, two gluons coming in, any number of gluons going out, some number of gluons going out, sorry. Oh, I should have said something too. we're going to assume that all the momenta are incoming. Okay. So momentum conservation is just the statement that these momenta add up to zero. Also, when we're talking about gluons, the gluons carry color. And so really, this is another important point. You can draw a nice diagram like this. Each gluon has a color and an anti-color. So we're always going to be talking about some fixed set of colors for the external gluons in what I'm talking about. So in particular, everything that I'm going to be talking about is going to have a nice cyclic structure in these particles 1 through n that just corresponds to rotating the whole diagram over, clocking it over by 1. Okay, so now it's meaningful to label these guys 1 to 3 up to n. And an amazing discovery that was made in the 1980s was that something astonishing happens when two of the helicities are negative and the remainder are positive. So let's say helicity I is negative and helicity j is negative, and the rest of them are positive. Park and Taylor discovered in the 80s that this is given by the following one-line formula in this leading approximation, again, where I'm neglecting loops. So those 220 Feynman diagrams for 6 particles collapse to that single formula. But for any number of particles, it collapses to this formula. And you can very easily verify that, again, everything has the correct transformation properties. So this was already an amazing clue that there should be some better way of thinking about things that makes these kind of astonishing simplicity manifest. What is not going to make manifest, as I've said a number of times, what it's not going to make manifest is that this has a very obviously local description, because that's what Feynman diagrams make manifest. Okay. So what I now want to talk about is the more recent progress. And the more recent progress is centered around, at least in gauge theories, is centered around understanding scattering amplitudes in a particularly simple theory, the maximally supersymmetric version of four-dimensional gauge theories, which is which has 16 supercharges. So it's known as n equals 4 super Yang Mills. And actually, I can easily motivate why supersymmetry is going to be so nice for this story in a way that's probably quite dissimilar from other motivations you've heard for supersymmetry. You see, we've gone quite a ways now. Already, we're describing the amplitude in terms of these nice spin helicity variables, but there's still something ugly. The amplitudes are still labeled by these annoying helicities, which are pluses and minus 1. Okay, so there's 2 to the n different amplitudes for gluons that we could be talking about, and it's just annoying to have that choppy discrete label on everything. Okay, this is why maximal supersymmetry is so useful. With maximal, you probably know that supersymmetry relates particles of different spins to each other. So if you have a single gluon state there with helicity negative 1, if you had a single supersymmetry, it would relate it to some fermionic partner of it that would have helicity negative a half. And similarly, if you had some guy with helicity plus 1 up here, it would relate it to a friend which has helicity plus a half. It would reduce it by a half. Okay. But you can see that if you have more supersymmetries, you might be able to go further up. Okay. If you have twice as many supersymmetries, you can go to the middle. And if you have 4 times as much supersymmetry, you can actually relate all of these guys to each other and put them in one gigantic multiplet. It's just the simple fact that if we start at the bottom, and we act with anti-commuting with anti-commuting operators, if we have four different such operators, I can ladder myself all the way up from spin negative one to spin plus one, and connect all of these guys with each other. Okay, so and in so doing, we just figure out the spectrum. We just figured out the spectrum of n equals four superangles. So there's a helicity negative one, negative a half, zero, plus a half, and plus one. And there's just the fourth row of Pascal's triangle, number of degrees of freedom. Okay. All right. Now, so far, this doesn't seem like it's bought us much. We just seem to have added many extra degrees of freedom. But the point is that instead of labeling them with this ugly discrete label, H, we can label them in a better way. We can label them in terms of a smooth variable, which diagonalizes the action of one of the two. There's two different sets of supercharges that don't anti-commute with each other, but we can pick one of them and diagonalize the action of this supercharge. So we can work with a particular combination of these guys, which we can add together using using some Grassmann variables. Actually, I conventionally like to put tildes on top of these guys. Doesn't matter. And now we have a smooth way of labeling all of these variables. We no longer have these discrete choppy indices. We just have a function now of lambda tilde, and eta tilde now for all the external particles. Okay. And if you want any particular helicity combinations, you just have to project out the appropriate power of the eta tilde. You see, here you may have noticed something. This denominator was this beautiful cyclically invariant thing. The numerator isn't cyclically invariant. It has this ij to the fourth in it. Of course, that's because this thing is not exactly cyclically invariant. I and j are negative helicity. The other guys are positive helicity. Okay. But when we label all the external states in this way, then this amplitude is honestly perfectly cyclic. Okay. And for instance, I can write the superversion of this amplitude in a way that's manifestly cyclically invariant. Okay. So it's a Grassmann delta function. It's just a polynomial in the eta tildes. If you project out the appropriate components to get the components, you'll get that. But now this is manifestly a beautifully cyclic object. All right. So that's it for the most. So now at least we're talking about something which is being named in the nicest possible way. And so the goal is, it's not quite the nicest possible way, but certainly nicer than before. And so the goal of the program is to find some way of computing Mn of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde without using Feynman diagrams. Okay, just get the answer some other way. And along the way, we'll see, as I said a number of times, a number of remarkable new physical structures, as well as some really surprising, to me at least, connections with areas of mathematics that have never played any significant role in physics before, but seem to be deeply, deeply connected to this physics. Okay. So that was all kinematics. And so let me now fast forward to start talking about some of the amazing symmetries of this theory. Visible and hidden. And the amazing thing is that there were symmetries that were hiding in, not really in plain sight. You have to really know where to look for them. But there were infinite dimensional symmetries of even pure Yang-Mills theory, just as a classical statement, that could have been discovered in 1954, 1955, in principle, by some alien who knew where to look for them, maybe, but weren't discovered till 4 years ago. Okay. So if we talk about this theory, classically, just like pure Yang-Mills theory, there are no mass parameters, so the theory is scale invariant. Now, this theory happens to be scale invariant fully quantum mechanically as well, okay, including all loop corrections. A remarkable feature of every theory we know, which is relativistic and scale invariant, is that it has a more exciting symmetry, which is conformal invariance. Scale invariance is obvious. If you have no scales, you can rescale everything. Conformal invariance is really not obvious. And its juice is the physics of inversions, or the symmetry of inversions, is that if you take a point x, you can replace x with x mu over x squared, and the physics is invariant. Those of you who are not high-energy physicists will have run into this in introductory E&M courses, where you are asked to solve for the problem of finding the electric field outside a grounded conducting sphere. Okay? You do that by using the method of images, and you put an image, magically it works that you put an image at this point, x over x squared, with some appropriate charge, so that's an equipotential surface. That magic trick is because the theory is conformally invariant, or has inversions as asymmetry. Okay. Now, this should actually, so there's a much bigger symmetry, which is bigger than, so the whole group of inversions, scale invariants, Lorentz invariants, translations, closes into this big conformal group. And already, you can see that there is something a little bit odd about the way we describe this physics in ordinary terms. This is a one big group, but we describe its different components, again, when we use the usual space-time variables like this, we describe its different components in rather different ways. Okay? So the translations, the Lorentz transformations, rotations, and the inversions are described rather differently. So this is a place where we start getting mileage again by using better variables. And so there could be a whole talk just given on this subject, but I'll have to spend only 2 minutes on it. This has to do with Twister space. And so every time there's at least a four-dimensional system with conformal symmetry, there's a useful Twister space associated with it. The idea is to not look at points in space-time. Don't look at points in space-time. Well, more primary than points in space-time are null rays in space-time. If you want to describe a null ray in space-time, you can give a simple equation for it. If I use those little 2x2 matrices, here's a simple equation. Here's a simple linear equation. Mu and lambda are just external data. And I solve for all the x's that satisfy that little equation. So this is obviously a line. It's a linear equation for x. It's a line. And you can very easily show that two different points on this line are light-like separated from each other. If you just subtract this equation for two different points, x1 and x2, you discover that x1 minus x2 on lambda is equal to 0, which means x1 minus x2 has a 0 eigenvector, so it has the square root of 0. Okay? Okay, so so if I want to describe a line in space-time, I can get it by giving you this four-plet of variables, a mu and a lambda. Of course, you'll notice that that equation, mu minus x lambda equals zero, I can rescale by any constant value that I like. And so it's not just mu and lambda, but mu and lambda identified with any constant times mu and lambda. Okay. So really what I'm talking about is a point. So you can think of it as a point in a, you can think about mu and lambda as living in C4, but everything that we do with it had better be invariant under rescaling it by arbitrary amounts. So really, we are talking about points in C4 modulo that modulo rescaling by anything, which is the complex projective space. But you can always just think of it just as a little four-dimensional vector up to any rescalings. Okay, now why are these lovely variables? The conformal group acts on mu and lambda like trivial conformal like trivial four-dimensional linear transformations of determinant 1. So we're not treating the different elements of the conformal symmetry on in a different way. They're all being treated uniformly on these guys. For example, Lorentz transformations just rotate the mu's or the lambdas. Rescaling is obvious. What about the inversion? Well, if you just take this equation and you divide by x squared, you get exactly the same equation with the role of mu and lambda interchanged. So the inversions are just the dumb 4 by 4 linear transformation that swaps mu and lambda. Okay. So the conformal group is then beautifully represented just as SL4 acting on mu and lambda. So that's the most basic part of the twister correspondence. Well, the second part of it is, so we see something non-local in space-time is something local in twister space, is a point in twister space. What if you take two points in twister space? Two points in twister space, well, there's two equations, mu1 minus x lambda 1 equals 0, mu2 minus x lambda 2 equals 0, and you can wonder if they have a common solution. They do, but you can in fact uniquely find an x which is like mu1 lambda 2 minus mu2 lambda 1 over lambda 1 lambda 2 that satisfies both of these equations. Okay. So given two points in twister space, we have a point in spacetime. That's how we describe a point in spacetime. Except you see that obviously I can do take any linear combination of these two equations that I want and it won't change what that point is. That means that anything I do with these two points, if I do any 2 by 2 linear transformation on them, I should end up with the same point. So it's not really a function of two points. It's just a function of this line in twister space. So that's the second part of the correspondence. Okay? A line in twister space is a point in space-time. A line in space-time, a null ray in space-time, is a point in twister space. So these, again, are much, much nicer variables to deal with, talk about theories that have a conformal symmetry. Okay. And there are ways, I won't talk about it now, there are ways of transforming amplitudes that are functions of lambdas and lambda tildes into things which are functions of twister variables that makes this, that allows you to exploit this simplicity a little bit. But for now, this was all about the visible symmetry, the obvious symmetry of n equals 4 super Young knots. So this is where some of the craziness starts, where some of the really remarkable things start. There's another symmetry, and to see this, it's very important to remember that I'm talking about situations where there's a natural cyclic ordering of the external particles. As I showed you at tree level, there's always a natural cyclic ordering of the external particles. At loop level, there's also a natural cyclic ordering of the external particles if you restrict yourself to just drawing planar diagrams, planar Feynman diagrams. That corresponds to taking a particular limit if you send the number of colors to infinity. And it's been very, very well known to be the first place to try to understand anything. If you're not going to understand the planar limit, you're surely not going to understand it for non-planar situations. So if we have planar diagrams, there's a natural cyclic ordering to the external particles. And so the following picture is meaningful. Let me draw the momentum of particle 1, then the momentum of particle 2, the momentum of particle 3, 4, and particle n. Because the momenta add up to 0, this closes into a polygon, into a closed polygon. So I've drawn this picture in some funny space. This is a space where the units of coordinate in this space, the units are momenta, but there's this natural closed polygon in this space. If you like, we can write that PA is XA plus 1 minus XA, where these are then the vertices of this polygon in this funny X space. The astonishing fact that was discovered experimentally and then understood a lot better and has been a real engine in developing this our understanding of this theory is that there's a second set of conformal symmetries. The second set of conformal symmetries is conformal transformations in X space. Now, many of these symmetries are some of the symmetries are shared between one side and the other. Lorentz transformations are the same on one side and the other. Scale transformations are the same on one side and the other. But the exciting part, the inversions are totally different on one side than the other. Okay.
Yes. Do you have two things called X at this
point? Do I have two? You mean this X and that X?
Yeah.
Alas, let's just call that Y. You rapidly run out of variables in this business. So, right. So I guess that's Y2 and Y1. So, okay. So this is just this is totally unexpected. Okay, it's completely invisible in the Lagrangian, and it's just a property of the answer. It's as if the theory has a second space on which it wants to be defined. Okay? A second space on which it has some nice sort of, well, we'll talk about more evidence for it later, but there's a totally second space on which it wants to be thought about, where there's the coordinates in that space are like momenta in our space, or like differences, or momenta are differences of coordinates in that space. Now, there is a more specific proposal which is that there are these two, there's the usual space and there's a dual space, and in the usual space we have some objects that we compute and we call scattering amplitudes. And that same object has a name in this dual space. It's the expectation value of a Wilson loop around this closed polygon. You can think of this as being like the Aronoff-Bohm phase. If you took a colored particle and dragged it around a polygon, this polygon, this funny polygon with whose edges are null. Okay. And there's very recently there's been an enormous amount of progress in completely solidifying this story and really coming up with a complete correspondence between between these things and those things. This is useful for many reasons. One of them is that a one-loop calculation on this side turns out to be related roughly to a tree calculation on that side. Two-loop on this side, one-loop on that side, very roughly. So things get a little bit easier on this side. You know, eventually 20 loops and 19 loops isn't going to be so much better unless you have a totally different way of thinking about things. But still, it's extremely useful to make progress and gather a lot more data. And that's a lot more theoretical data about what the structure of the amplitudes actually are. Okay. I should also say that that using this picture, a huge amount of progress has also been made in understanding what these scattering amplitudes look like when the coupling constant is very strong. When the coupling constant is when the coupling constant is strong, which is when we have no idea how to compute it anyway, from traditional methods, one can map this problem to the problem of finding minimal area surfaces, soap bubbles, areas of soap bubbles that happen to be soap bubbles that fall into empty De Sitter space, rather than ordinary soap bubbles in three-dimensional space. But who's but where the little where the net that's making the soap bubble has as its boundary this null Wilson loop, and there too. If you just set up the problem of computing that surface and then computing its area, it seems like a completely intractable, impossible problem. But miracles happen that allow you to compute it. Okay. Compute it indirectly, but compute it nonetheless. And there are starting to be fishing lines sent from both sides. You know, things that you can compute at weak coupling, things that you can compute at strong coupling, and match from both sides. So, so this fact, you know, up to this point, and I haven't told you about, I haven't shown you a lot of the explicit examples of. A lot of the explicit examples of scattering amplitudes that have been computed using various methods, where you could see the results are astonishingly simple. Just that simplicity was already enough to convince many people, certainly to convince me, that there was some actual new structure governing it all. But if you're a physicist and you see symmetries that you don't understand, that's a real indication that there's something big missing. Okay, and again, I'll say it one more time. This symmetry is even there at tree level. Okay, it's there in principle in pure Yang mills. In the classical limit, there's an incredible symmetry that could have been noticed but wasn't for a long time. Okay, now. So I just want to end by saying a few words about how this sort of correspondence has been established, which is also related to trying to find a more manifestly symmetrical way of talking about all of this physics. You see, I should say that if you take the visible conformal symmetry and the hidden conformal symmetry and you commute them with each other, you get an infinite dimensional algebra. This infinite dimensional algebra is known as a Yangian, and it's a Yangian of the particular group, which is SL4/4. So this /4 is because it's supersymmetric. SLs, because I'm just talking about everything in a complex language, so you could specialize it to various real forms like SU22/4, PSU22/4, whatever. But in a complex, complexified is just SL4/4. And this is something else which is absolutely remarkable, because of course these things have come up before in physics. They come up if you've ever studied the Heisenberg spin chain. The fact that you can the fact that you can solve this problem exactly 100 different ways, the Hamiltonian is just the nearest neighbor S dot S couplings, is related to the fact that there's actually that this theory is integrable. There's an infinite number of charges that commute with H, non-local charges that commute with H. Here's one of them, just the sum over I less than J of the commutator of Si and Sj commutes with H, for example. Okay? But the infinite dimensional symmetry in this case is the Yangian of SU2. So somehow we have something that's not dissimilar to that, except we're not talking about the spins in 1 plus 1 dimensions, apparently. We're talking about gluons in 4 dimensions. Okay. So this is a gigantic symmetry, and it's clearly useful to try to describe it and talk about it in a way that makes it as manifest as possible. Okay? This description and that description makes half of the symmetries manifest. Okay? So we have nice space-time words to associate. If we want to make conformal invariance obvious, we have a nice local question. We ask about scattering amplitudes. If we want to make the dual conformal invariance manifest, we can talk about the expectation value of this Wilson loop, this Aronoff-Bohm phase of the colored particle. Both of those are perfectly good and complete descriptions of the physics, but they don't make the full infinite dimensional symmetry manifest. The full infinite dimensional symmetry cannot be made manifest if you have any local description of the physics, for obvious reasons. Okay. The two symmetries act on mutually non-local spaces. So it's useful to try and understand a way of talking about this where we can make all of the symmetries manifest. So that's the last thing that I want to talk about. Oh, before I do that, I should have said one more thing to complete the symmetry on both sides. Here, because there's conformal invariance, it's useful to use twister variables. So too here. To make conformal invariance on this side, it's useful to use twister variables that are appropriate to this dual space, which we can call momentum twister variables to remind us that they're associated with this space. And the picture is particularly simple and beautiful. If you have this polygon, again, we want to talk about conformal symmetries in this space. So it's useful to use twister variables. That point in space-time is associated with a line in twister space. That point in space-time is associated with another line in that twister space. That one is associated with another one, and so on. Now, why have I drawn them so that one intersects the next? I think I neglected to say this before, but the fact that the conformal group is SL4 is a beautiful thing about using twister variables is it allows you to visualize the geometry associated with conformal symmetry in a completely trivial way. It's just projective geometry in 3 dimensions. That means you can visualize everything in terms of good old-fashioned points, lines, and planes in 3-dimensional space. And any question, any conformally invariant question can only involve incidence relations between these points, lanes, and these points, lines, and planes. For example, if I have 2 points that are null separated from each other, what could possibly that special statement mean on this side? I have a line, I have another line. The only possible projective relationship that they can have is that they intersect or not. So if they're light-like separated, they intersect. Otherwise, they don't. Okay, so associated with that polygon, there is another polygon in the associated twister space. But now, you see, the lovely thing is that we can just label these variables we can label this polygon just by drawing its intersection points. If I hand you a random set of z1 up to zn, you can form this polygon in a twister space. You can map it back to points in spacetime just using those formulas that I told you, and it's guaranteed to give you a bunch of variables which are null separated from each other and which give you a bunch of points that are null separated from each other and give you a closed polygon. So this has really completed the journey of trivializing kinematics, absolutely trivializing kinematics. We give completely unconstrained z's. Random unconstrained z's, and this builds for us a set of momenta that are null and conserve momentum. And as a bonus, the conformal transformations act on them trivially as SL4. Okay. So that's the from the space-time perspective, we're done. I mean, we're done defining the objects. We have scattering amplitudes in the usual space, Wilson loops in the dual space. There's associated twister spaces that make our life a lot easier, and each one of these descriptions makes half of the symmetries manifest, although this infinite dimensional symmetry that comes from all of them is obscured. Okay, so in the last 15 minutes, I want to tell you a little bit.
Hold on a second.
15.
Well, we have...
This
is an hour and 15 minutes. I just wanted to break it to say if anybody does want to leave...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh.
Usually it's an hour.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I thought it was an hour and a half. So, oh, sorry. I would have given a different time. should we just ask anyone who wants to leave to leave?
Yeah, that's what I did.
Okay. All right.
Actually, before you erase this, can you maybe say two more words? When you're computing this Wilson loop, on what space does the gauge field live?
In that space. Well, yeah.
No, because this is momentum space, right? I mean,
pretend it's a normal coordinate space. That's the whole point. It's as if it's just a good old-fashioned normal coordinate space.
Okay, so your path ordering is a path in momentum space then?
Well, it's a path in this space. So we just made up this space and drawn this polygon. Now, totally forget about the motivations. Someone just handed you a polygon with null separated edges, with null edges, and asked you to compute its Wilson loop. It's a very nice question. No reason at all for you to expect it has anything to do with scattering amplitudes in a totally other space, but it's a perfectly nice question, and you could compute it using the Yang-Mills theory in this space.
Okay, but where this position in this space right. plays the well, it's
roll momentum in the other space. Momentum. Exactly. All right. I should say that already, all of these developments at weak coupling, at strong coupling, even with these, both of these sides. Have exposed a number of remarkable new kinds of integrable structures, mathematical structures. But I'm going to talk about yet another one, which is striking to me both for the extreme simplicity of the ingredients. And the fact, as I mentioned, that it seems to connect with some deep areas of algebraic geometry, in a way that's very combinatorial, I'll say a little bit about it. Okay, well I have zero time, so I will just have to make the following. I'll have to make this. Let me just make a declaration. Okay. So. I mentioned to you that we're interested in amplitudes that depend on n particles. Something that I could have said, I should have also said, is that it's natural to break these guys up into something that's labeled by another index, K, where K is the number of negative helicity gluons. This is a whole big superamplitude, let's say. But it is natural to break it up into the set that that have a certain number of negative helicity gluons. In fact, it's easy to show that if k equals 0 or 1, these amplitudes vanish. If k equals 2, is the first time that they're non-trivial, and that was the formula that we wrote down with the Park-Taylor, that Park-Taylor formula with 2 negative and the rest positive. So so it's just it's a useful bookkeeping device. These pieces of the superamplitudes don't mix with each other. They're different natural sectors, and so we can talk about putting them together. Okay. So the data is then given by K and N and a bunch of external particles. Okay, so associated with that, we look at, and I'm just going to have to declare this. Imagine drawing an n-dimensional space and looking at the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions. Now, why would we do something like that? Well, if we just imagine looking at the lambdas and the lambda tildes alone, each one of these lambdas, there are two Lorentz components here. Let me call them A and A dot. Each one of them is A equals 1 is some n-dimensional vector. A equals 2 is some n-dimensional vector. But remember, we have Lorentz transformations acting on these guys. So more Lorentz invariantly, I can talk about a two-dimensional plane that's spanned by them. Similarly, there's a two-dimensional plane that's spanned by these guys, lambda tildes. And I've drawn them this way because momentum conservation is a simple statement that these planes are orthogonal to each other. The sum of lambda A, lambda tilde A is equal to 0. Just says that these two planes are orthogonal to each other. Or said more invariantly, that one of them is in the complement of the other. So already, even without any other motivation, just the external data is given to us in terms of planes, in terms of two planes in n dimensions. If we went to twister space, there would be a four-plane in n dimensions, the space of the mu's and the lambdas. Okay? This is really built into the simple fact that Lorentz transformations are SL. It was sort of screaming out the whole time, SL, SL. These SLs have to do with planes. Okay? They just have to do with the... Okay, so... So you see that momentum conservation is a slightly interesting statement. It's a quadratic constraint on the external data. It's not a trivial statement. That shouldn't surprise you because momentum conservation is normally trivial as a consequence of translational invariance in space-time, but it's because we have the hole inside of the space-time to talk about. In this whole picture, we don't have the hole inside of the space-time. That's the point. Or that's something that we might hope to see. So that momentum conservation is indeed an interesting statement. Okay, so we're going to interpret momentum conservation in a slightly different way by introducing this third object, this auxiliary object, a k-plane in n dimensions. And we're going to declare, so if this is a k-plane CK, we're going to declare that this k-plane contains the lambda 2-plane, and it's orthogonal to the lambda tilde 2-plane. That clearly forces lambda and lambda tilde to be orthogonal to each other. Okay. All right. Now, in general, notice that if k equals 1, 0, or 1, there is no such plane that contains 1, just it isn't high enough dimensional. That's good because the amplitudes vanish if k equals 0 or 1. Okay. So it's first interesting when k equals 2, where that plane is unique. It is just the lambda plane. But for general k and n, there's many c's that satisfy that constraint. So then all we do is integrate over all these k planes in n dimensions, imposing that picture. That picture turns out in twister space to be the very simple statement: if I want to parametrize the k-plane, I can give you k n-dimensional vectors whose span gives me the plane, and then I just write the statement that the c is orthogonal to the four-plane of twister variables. Okay, so this perfectly just translates that picture into a statement in twister space. And then we have to choose some measure to integrate over all these objects. And it turns out that this measure does something, is both remarkably simple and does something very, very interesting. Okay. So what I've done, I have to give you a measure over this over the space of k-planes in n dimensions. The space is known as the Grassmannian, GKN. And to give you a measure, I have to make up the only things I can do. Because this is supposed to just be about the k-plane, I have to invariance into doing any k by k linear transformations on these vectors. So I can come up with a measure that's just built out of the minors of this k by n matrix. And this is the simplest measure that I can come up with, which has some remnant of this, has some obvious built-in cyclic structure that we know the amplitudes have to have. So I describe things in this way just to emphasize how far, I mean, we're not talking about Lagrangians, we're not talking about diagrams, gauge theories, nothing, right? We're just talking about k-planes and n dimensions. All the magic, by the way, is here. All the magic is here. It's in this particular structure of the cyclic minors that make an appearance in the measure. But this turns out to be a very interesting object for both physical and mathematical reasons. Okay. The mathematical statement is that this generates all of the invariants of that Yangian symmetry. It's not a completely obvious fact, but it's a pretty straightforward fact to prove. You have to interpret this as a multidimensional contour integral, and the residues of this contour integral turn out to be in one-to-one correspondence with Yangian invariants. More than that, there are lots of relations between these invariants, very non-trivial algebraic relations between the invariants. Those relations are related to physical things like locality and unitarity in the actual amplitudes, but those non-trivial relationships are reflected in residue theorems, higher dimensional residue theorems in this contour integral. And physically, because this gives you a menu of everything that you can build, which are Yangian invariant, you can start with residues of this object and putting them together, combining them together using some simple canonical operations. You can recursively build the entire integrand for the scattering amplitudes, not just at tree level, but to all loop orders in n equals 4 super Yang bells. A very important point is that the amplitudes can be determined by their, the amplitudes can be determined using their singularities in a way that I don't have time to go into in detail right now, but they can be determined using their singularities. This has been a very, very powerful tool. These BCFW, so-called BCFW recursion relations have been a very powerful tool for understanding tree amplitudes for a long time. They helped develop lots and lots of data to see what the structure is. But they can be extended to all loop order. And so there's two important points. A, that there is a complete definition of what the integrand is, the thing that you integrate to get the whole amplitude at any loop order. But B, all the objects that appear are associated with this one, okay, by jamming together the residues from this object in natural ways to a buildup, not just the trees, but also all of the loops. And so that makes this Yangian invariance completely manifest. It does not make locality or unitarity in any way manifest. Okay? It's a description of the physics where the usual words, Lagrangian, path integral, gauge symmetry, etc., make no appearance whatsoever. Okay? Instead, what makes an appearance are these K by N matrices and this interesting cyclic structure in the Grassmannian. Now, the importance of this, apart from providing allowing us to actually do computations, and I haven't stressed this, but these things have the recursive definition of the amplitude has allowed us to compute things that were I think not easy to imagine having computed before. So it's actually practical. It's useful for doing computations. But it's also it's been a bridge that allows you to compare the different formulations of the theory. So when I told you we have these two different space-time pictures, there's the amplitude on one side and the Wilson loop on the other side, and it's now really been proven that they're equivalent to each other. They're proven to be equivalent by showing that they satisfy exactly the same recursion relation. Okay? So in order to see this full Yangian symmetry, you don't go from one and then just do something to it and immediately take it over to the other. You bring it to this common intermediate place, which has no standard, has no usual description, but which makes all these symmetries manifest. And perhaps I can just say that this kind of structure is not been, I mean, mathematicians have studied Grassmannians for a long time, but this sort of cyclic structure on the Grassmannians has not been studied in detail. We're in the middle of having some wonderful discussions with a number of mathematicians about this, and I found out that some of the structures have been looked at and are similar, sort of very recently, as of sort of three or four years ago. But there are things about them that we know from physics that would totally astonish them. Okay. Just to give you just a tiny flavor, and then I'll end with this. Just to give you a tiny flavor of the sorts of structure that are involved, just because it's so simple to say. Let me tell you how to characterize all of the residues of this object. Okay? So pick any k and n that you like. For example, let me pick k equals 3, n equals 6. And draw a bunch of points in a projective k minus one dimensional space. So this is a points in CP2. N points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So just start off doing that. These are six completely generic points. Okay? Now we're going to make more special configurations. We're going to make more special configurations by forcing there to be linear dependencies between k consecutive guys. See, here I have, there's some interesting structure involving k consecutive minors. I'm going to force there to be some linear dependencies involving k consecutive guys. For example, I could make a more special configuration by making 1, 2, 3 collinear. That loses, that imposes one more constraint. Or I could make 2, 3, 4 collinear and so on. Okay. You can formally think about this operation of imposing one more constraint as taking a boundary. So if I start with the general six points and I take a boundary, I would get a sum of a bunch of terms. This one was 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 6, and so on. Okay? But it gets more interesting as you take the boundary more often, and you start producing more and more interesting configurations. It deserves to be called the boundary because you can relatively easily show that the boundary squared is equal to 0. Okay? So for instance, if I do the simplest case, actually, is k equals 2, n equals 4, where I just start with a point in just the projective line, just on CP1. Okay? 1, 2, 3, 4. Then the boundary would involve making things a little more special, which in this case would be, for instance, so if I call that 1, 2, 3, 4, a boundary would involve something like 1 and 2 on top of each other, then 3, then 4, and the other ones. So this one I can denote 1, 2, 3, 4, and there's 3 more. Then I can make this one more special. For instance, I could put 1, 2, and 3 all on top of each other, and 4. Or I could put 1, 2 on top of each other, and then 3, 4, and so on. Okay? In each case, I go down imposing one more constraint, making a one step more special configuration. So far, there seems to be nothing going on here, right? Until you start actually counting how many of them you have. So if you have the first one, say we have one of these, and by taking this process four times, you can see that I can get down to all the pairs of points, six pairs of points here. Let's call those points. So this F is standing for face. So this is a 4 face and a 0 face. Well, so if you just count how many of them you have one of these guys, 4, 3 faces, 10, 2 faces, 12, 1 faces, and 6, 0 faces. Okay? Now, if you look at 1 minus 4 plus 10 minus 12 plus 6, the Euler character is 1. So purely combinatorially, calling these things boundaries actually lets you assemble these objects into a ball, a four-dimensional ball. We could draw a three-dimensional face in this four-dimensional ball, but I don't have time to do it. This case may be a little accidental, but then you keep going. You keep going, you look at n equals k equals 6, n equals 10 for fun. Do exactly the same exercise. Now it's a 24-dimensional object. 1 there. Sorry. 10 of these, just to give you some idea, 220 of these, 55 of these. I won't write out all of them, just so you see somewhere in between. You have 320,820 of these, 294,420 of these. Okay, tuck, 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 till you have 2,520 edges and 210 points. Okay. V minus E plus F, the Euler character is 1,200,245 minus 1,200,244 is equal to 1. Okay? This is an absolute miracle. Starting from nothing, just talking about just linear dependencies of consecutive guys, the combinatorics is building up a polytope. And the polytope lives in GKN. Okay. It turns out that this polytope has been studied. And this is the object that started being studied in the 90s. And 4 years ago, it was proven that this combinatorics always makes it add up to 1. It is at least combinatorially a ball. Okay. Now, what does this have to do with physics? Let's say we want to compute Yangian invariants. So this part, of course, the mathematicians knew nothing about. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So if I take that formula that I just wrote down for you, instead of doing delta 2 slash 4 slash 4, I do delta m slash m in general. It turns out that Yangian invariants, all Yangian invariants, are simply associated with, and there's an explicit formula for them, associated with every m times k dimensional face of this polytope. All the relations between Yangian invariants begin, the relations are to begin with an mk plus one dimensional face and just sum over all the residues associated with this boundary. Okay. And what's in progress right now is the beginning of an understanding that the amplitudes are themselves associated with balls, lower dimensional balls. So you take this gigantic object, but you extract from it lower dimensional faces of the appropriate dimensionality. And again, the combinatorics works out miraculously so that they exist and they form the boundary of the appropriate dimensional ball. And the fact that that's possible is intimately related to the fact that we can write down amplitudes that are local in space-time. So this is this fact, the fact that this the polytope, the big thing, the big object has been, as I mentioned, well studied, but the fact that that these lower dimensional subpieces exist that correspond to what are obviously to us as physicists the interesting things, the amplitudes themselves, is news, and is interesting. So I just hope you get a flavor. I just wanted to go through this a little bit, not to explain it in any detail, but just so you get a flavor of what an intermediate description that sees all the symmetries might look like. Great. It's very foreign. It's very far from familiar pictures, but it seems to be associated with some extremely simple and nice combinatorial structure. All right, that's it. Unfortunately, I didn't have any chance to talk about gravity, so hopefully someone else can tell you some of the remarkable things that have been going on relating some of these things to gravitational amplitudes too. Thanks a lot.
I suspect some people would like a glass of wine, so why don't
you continue the discussion across the